Take the bass line out. Uh-huh. Here go. Yeah. Let it bump, though.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Hardwood Knox podcast as we continue rolling through our season preview packages. We're moving on to the Los Angeles Clippers, and while Andy is not here with me, Dan Favalli, we are lucky enough to have Adam Spinella of NBA Math and B-Ball Breakdown. He is also a basketball coach, an X's and O's savant, and, you know, the Clippers were one of the teams that when I talked to him, he specifically mentioned that he would like to do so. I'm very excited to have him on. How are you doing today, Adam?
Oh, Dan, I'm doing great. Finally ready to dive into these Los Angeles Clippers, one of the strangest teams after this offseason and heading into next year. It'll be fun to digest.
Could they be the strangest team? You had brought this up before the podcast. Now, like, I'm just looking when you think about their roster, it's just weird. But I'm actually looking at their depth chart right now, and it's just so topsy turvy.
Yeah, I'm looking at their depth chart too, and I see basically like 4 point guards that can play, and then like three or four interior guys. And then a couple mismatch forwards and zero wings, with the exception of maybe DeAndre Liggins. But like, they are the strangest collection of a fairly talented roster, and it's going to be really interesting to see what Doc Rivers and company really make of this.
I think where we have to start is obviously the Chris Paul trade, and the haul they got was fantastic. Particularly under the circumstances, just because if he would have left, he still could have just signed with the Rockets for less money. I know it was easier this way, and they have his bird rights, so they kind of do him a solid too. But to know that he's going to be a free agent and could just leave, to get what they did was, especially with Patrick Beverley, who is still with 2 years left on that deal, is one of the best contracts in the NBA, probably one of the 5 to 7 best contracts overall. And just to even get Lou Williams, Sam Decker, just all these pieces, even Montrezl Harrell, who I very much like. It was a very good return that they got for him, and I think that is necessary context when we're talking about their roster, because they did just lose a top 10 player.
Yeah, we look at a lot of these trades for superstars, and there have been way more over the last 3 or 4 years than I think probably the decade prior to that. But we look at most of them based off of who's the best player that the team got back in return. You know, in the Paul George trade this year, we look at Victor Oladipo going to Indianapolis. Jimmy Butler, we see Zach LaVine. I don't know if there is one real high upside kind of 15 to 20 points per game guy that the Clippers got. But in terms of overall haul and depth and getting exactly what they needed to flank Blake Griffin moving forward, I mean, it is as solid, just rock solid and steady a group of four players as you can get given the circumstances and lack of leverage they had.
How does this offense change now without Chris Paul? And I know one of the things Doc Rivers mentioned was ball movement, which people probably overblew it, because if you're not going to have one of the most ball-dominant point guards in the NBA on your roster, the ball is going to just have to move more, even when you have shot creators like Danilo Gallinari, like Blake Griffin. Maybe poor word choice there, but I know you run through Blake, but like, how do you do this now? Because the when you look at the numbers, like, they've been sort of on and off in terms of his on and off splits with and without Chris Paul over the past 3 years, where the offense hasn't always been good, but sometimes it's been great. How do you see this offense operating now that you're removing Chris Paul from the fold and putting in a bunch of these different guys?
I think what helps them the most is having their shooting guards and their depth there, both Austin Rivers and Lou Williams, if we want to call them shooting guards. They're both guys that can handle the ball and initiate offense. Patrick Beverley has been maximized in his career in Houston because he doesn't have any playmaking duties whatsoever. And being able to have guards that can create off of the pick and roll is really vital in today's NBA game. We, as coaches, a lot of us love ball movement. We love player movement. We love things that get everybody touches and everybody involved. But at the end of a shot clock or the end of the game, you need some sort of a bread and butter. And Rivers and Lou Williams aren't terrible in that. But in terms of their main motion and what they're going to be doing throughout the course of the game, I think it's going to be a lot of high post touches for Blake Griffin. Similar, perhaps, to the way that the Nuggets have been running things with Nikola Jokic at center there, is they'll put the ball at Blake's hands near the top of the key. They'll keep DeAndre Jordan somewhat low on the baseline, and they'll have three guys cutting and screening and moving around him. I would not be surprised at all to see a little bit of that type of offense and movement in surrounding Blake Griffin.
Do the Clippers have enough off-ball shooting to kind of make that work? They have shooters, and Gallo's a good off-ball shooter, and Patrick Beverley's a good off-ball shooter. Milos Teodosic is supposed to be a very good spot-up shooter, but it seems like when you kind of play that way through a big, you either need to operate extremely fast like the Nuggets do, or you need to have this huge collection of dead-eye spot-up shooters, which I guess the Nuggets kind of have, but they just seem to operate so quickly, even when it's in the half court and they're not necessarily running end-to-end. And I don't know if the Clippers are built that way to prop up this type of style for an entire season. It helps that you have Blake Griffin, who is still a top 20 player when he's healthy and on. And we saw that the Clippers' offense, I believe the on-off numbers had them scoring like a top three attack when it was him without Paul last year. So I get it. But to kind of see this in action, when I don't necessarily know that you have enough guaranteed shooters, and now you're taking would have been relatively small samples over the last 6 years, and you're extrapolating them into one big season and asking Blake Griffin to carry your offense for that entire year.
Yeah, it's the question of the season for the Clippers on offense. You look at their spacing with DeAndre Jordan as their center, and he's kind of a zero-sum game, if you will. He can provide no spacing away from the basket. So when you have a guy like him at the center roaming the baseline and Blake Griffin near the top of the key with the ball in his hands, that leaves three players to space the floor to the corners and the wings as shooters. And I was wrestling with this question and thinking about this for a long time the other day. And I looked up all these shooters' stats for catch and shoot on the NBA stats dashboard and all their fancy player tracking thingamabobs and whatnot. And all guys that they have off the ball in their backcourt and on their wings are pretty solid. Austin Rivers was the one guy who worried me most, but he's above 40%. So I think they can provide that spacing. The issue and the biggest question then becomes, what exactly do the Clippers do when Blake Griffin isn't in the game? How do they create enough spacing? Because they're always going to be playing some sort of an immobile, non-skilled away from the basket center. How do they create enough driving lanes for someone else to be a creator? And to me, the only thing that they can do is stagger the minutes of Blake Griffin and Milos Teodosic. Those two have to play. The Clippers have to have at least one of them on the court at all times in order to get easy shots for the rest of their guys.
I was interested to see if that guy could maybe be Austin Rivers, because it seems like a role that he probably should be able to play at this point. But if you look at some of his numbers last season specifically, I looked this up before the podcast, the Clippers were just dreadful when he played without Blake Griffin and Chris Paul. I think they were about -7 points per 100 possessions with what would have been a mediocre offense at best and a terrible, terrible defense. So I guess it has to be Milos Teodosic. And you're right, you do have to stagger, because it's not even – we can sit here and talk about all the offensive questions we have. And I think looking at their roster, I agree wholeheartedly with you that they probably won't have trouble coming up with enough spacing, at least not when Blake Griffin's on the floor. And you can even look toward their numbers with him in the game without Paul last year to help. But some of these combinations that you might need offensively are going to be atrocious on the other end of the floor.
Yep.
The potential starting lineup is kind of interesting. I'm assuming they'll roll with Beverly, Rivers, Gallo, Griffin, and Jordan. And you look at Beverly and Jordan, they're fine. Those are guys who might win you your position battles on a nightly basis. Austin Rivers, I'm just, a lot of people like Austin Rivers. I'm just still not there. I could be talked into being indifferent with him defensively, but what the Gallo Blake Griffin combination, at some point it becomes important to stagger their minutes, does it not? Because Gallo should play some four, at least. He should probably be a full-time four, but he has to play some four. At the same time, you just gave Blake Griffin 170 plus million to be your four. And while the offensive ceiling on a Blake Griffin, Danilo Gallinari 4-5 combination is ridiculous, I shudder to think about what the defensive numbers would be in those situations.
Right. 100% accurate with that assessment on defense. I mean, that's what it comes down to, is those two as the four and five probably cannot survive together defensively. And in the Western Conference, you have to, because there's enough talented small ball teams out there that can just throttle you if you're not good on the defensive end. So staggering their minutes is vital. I look at the, again, I don't think the position estimate stats or play-by-play information on Basketball Reference is the end-all be-all, but it gives you a rough idea of where these guys play relative to their teammates and who they might court. And last year, Gallinari spent 62% of his minutes in the power forward spot. 62. Now, I look at his backup that they acquired in this Chris Paul trade, and that's Sam Decker. And to me, Decker was most useful by playing that small ball four role last year a little bit for the Rockets. That might have been where he had his biggest impact. B-ball reference had him down at 87% of his minutes came at the four last year. So the Clippers are really rolling with a bigger lineup and a bigger rotation, and how they're able to defend the really mobile threes and fours of the world is going to be strange. But in terms of staggering their minutes, yes, it is useful to maximize both Griffin and Gallo, but where does the relief come in on their second unit if it's Decker who's coming off the bench for Gallo and isn't that much more versatile defensively?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't even know what their best workable defensive combinations are. And even when you float the idea of, yeah, it helps, I guess that Harrell played five sometimes for Houston last year, but that doesn't help you out. Like, I'm just like, if you want to put Gallo at the four without Blake Griffin, maybe that's a lineup you try and use if you've already used DeAndre Jordan too much. But it's just so it's like you said, because Gallo seems like he's been increasingly spending more time at the four. I didn't double check that. To have him now all of a sudden be chained to the three full time almost. I don't know what percent of his minutes are going to come at the four this year. It'd probably be lucky if it's a quarter of his playing time, I would think. I just don't know what you do. And the only thing I can really think of is you have to hope that maybe you can parlay some of this mishmash of players that you have into a wing, maybe a more expensive wing. Do you try and, you know, use Lou Williams' expiring contract with Wes Johnson's cheap deal and see if Atlanta's willing to sell really low on Kent Bazemore at some point? I don't know, but it seems like for them to make any sort of noise in the West this year, any authentic noise anyway, they need another wing on the roster to kind of help offset the dilemma they now have with the Blake Griffin, Danilo Gallinari defensive combination.
Yeah, it's crazy to me, because I remember in the first few years of the Chris Paul, Blake Griffin era in Los Angeles. I mean, there were 6 years of this. We had our fair share of watching those two try to compete out in the West. And the first few years, the biggest frustration was, can somebody get them help at the small forward position? Because there's just nobody that's here. And it was year after year. I mean, we had a year of Grant Hill. We tried everybody at the small forward position, and they were all kind of below average 3-and-D guys on really small deals. Well, the first time somebody from the Clippers front office goes out and gets a marquee forward to fill that small forward spot, we look at the roster and we say, well, who the hell are they going to defend? Like, the way that it works, it's not a great fit. Like, talking about trade partners, like, yeah, I think perhaps packaging Lou Williams and Wes Johnson together with the expiring, maybe the Knicks try to give up on Courtney Lee and get out his deal a little bit and gain some cap relief because they have just so much wasted space on their roster. Like, there are guys that are out there for the Clippers to target. And ultimately, I think they're going to have to if they're going to compete. But again, that doesn't solve the problem of their two front court guys and Gallo and Griffin and their main backup, Sam Decker, are all going to struggle to defend wings defensively. And you don't solve that by adding one more wing to the equation necessarily.
And you know what's interesting is that I don't know what made them look at their small forward problems and think, we really need a guy who's going to be a marquee forward scorer at that position. Excuse me. Yeah. You found Lucan Bahamut was the best solution they found. He was fantastic on defense last year, and he is good when he plays small ball four, but you can survive with him at the 3-2, and he switches a lot of stuff. There probably weren't better options than Danilo Gallinari for them to attain, like they did through the sign and trade. But it almost seems like if you were worried about fit and you were worried about maximizing the potential of your roster for the next couple seasons around Blake Griffin, that looking into Luke and Bahamut would have been bringing him back would have been something you tried to do. Instead, he ends up on the minimum in Houston, maybe even going after an older guy like PJ Tucker before he signs in Houston. Or even Patrick Patterson might have ended up being good for this team, but he plays the four, so that's probably a bad example. But I don't know what made them think, looking at the roster they had, particularly after the Chris Paul trade and Doc Rivers and Jerry West and Steve Ballmer, whoever was making these decisions, would say, you know what, we need Danilo Gallinari, and let's give up the first-round pick we just got in the Chris Paul trade to get him.
I mean, look, I love Gallinari. I think that he's an odd fit on this roster, but you can't tell me that you'd rather have, with this roster and what they assembled post-Chris Paul trade, I have a really hard time believing that someone would rather have Danilo Gallinari than Jonathan Simmons and $8 million to spend.
Yeah,
that's really hard for me to believe.
Right, and it seems like it's this has been like a debate before within the basketball circles where it's easier to be more valuable as a one-sided player when you're an offense-first player as opposed to a defense-first player. But it seems like it's easier to kind of offset your weaknesses or become closer to, I guess, maskable in your most flawed areas if you're a defense first guy and they just worry about getting you offense, because that's essentially what the Clippers did for a lot of that Bahamut era. Is he was a good defender, he wasn't the best offensive player, and all of a sudden last year he pops off and shoots, you know, career best from 3-point range, and it works out. And it seems like they would have done well, again, especially looking at the rest of the roster, to target that type of a player. And you mentioned Jonathan Simmons would have been perfect. I know his price range probably wasn't too clear that early in the process because he waited so long to sign, but that's something that it's not even saying that it's saving them money. There's a chance that it would have made them appreciably better to go with a cheaper player who's better on the defensive end.
Yeah, and again, just kind of the mysteries of the rest of the roster. Like, if you have a guy like Simmons in that position and you still have a little bit of money to spend, don't know what you'd spend it on, but okay, you want to put Simmons at the three? That's great. Give him a 2-year deal. Maybe give him, I don't know, 10 to 12 for what he's looking for. Third year is a team option, so you can get out of that if you'd like. And then you still have a little bit of money to play with to add one more maybe backup shooter if you need it. Like, to me, and I'm sure we'll get into this topic in a little bit more depth, but there's a reason Doc Rivers isn't running things anymore. I love Doc. I grew up a Celtics fan, and watching him and those Celtics teams with the big three are some of the reasons why I became a coach, is because Doc Rivers was so masterful with that. But in terms of creating a roster and filling it in with, you know, filling in the holes with the right guys that complement their stars, I just haven't really seen that from him, and that's made it really, really tough to believe that the Clippers are going to be able to pick up the torch and run with it in the post CP3 era.
And we talk about Doc, and as a basketball executive, I guess you can't always, maybe you can't use the word terrible because they end up with JJ Redick when he's there, and you don't know if that happens if someone else is in his position. But as a coach now is where I don't like to call him overrated because I'm not sure who's saying he's a top five coach in the NBA right now. But we talked about the importance of staggering some of these guys' minutes or just even the slight tweaks that'll help you manufacture just an extra trace of spin at the four for Gallinari. Is he a guy that's going to do that? Because he never seemed like he staggered the minutes of his big three or of Blake Griffin and Chris Paul properly for most of their tenure together. I know injuries kind of threw him and the rest of the team for a whirl at points, but is he a guy, and we'll have to get into the basketball executive stuff, but looking from a coaching standpoint, is this a guy that you can trust to make the right systemic decisions or the right makeup lineup decisions for this roster moving forward?
Yeah, I think so. Maybe I'm just still wearing my 2008 drunk goggles for the NBA championship.
Anything's possible.
That's right. That's right. But last year was a very different year for the Clippers. You take a look at they had just this unbelievable start to the season. And everybody, including myself, was ready to anoint them a top contender, you know, perhaps even vaulting the Spurs out west to knock off the Warriors. And one of the reasons for that was because of the depth that they had. And the players that were, you know, in their backcourt that were really ready to step in and take minutes whenever their guys went to the bench. I mean, they went legitimately 10 deep. So they started Paul and Redick and Bamute and then, you know, Blake and Jordan up front. But off the bench, they brought in Rivers and Crawford and Felton. And Mo Spates was a very good small ball center that stretched out the floor.
Crawford.
The issue is the lack of spacing on that second unit. You know, Mo Spates isn't there. And instead they have Willie Reed and Montrezl Harrell, who are very similar to DeAndre Jordan and suck in a lot of defenders towards the rim. So how does Doc manufacture those driving lanes and scoring lanes with that second unit? Again, maybe I'm just too much of a Celtics homer right here, but I go back to that 08 team with how he managed the rotations. I mean, he very rarely played Nate Robinson on the floor in, was that 2010, 2008, whatever year that was. He very rarely played Nate Robinson without Tony Allen there to flank him. I mean, he's going to do things to give the Clippers the best offense-defense balance that he can find, because you can't sacrifice one in order to gain proficiency at the other. So my trust does lie in Doc, the coach, to try to figure out the best solution that's there. The issue may be Doc, the GM, could have created too poor of a best solution answer for the Clippers to be able to really win games with.
It's fascinating because they seem deeper than they've seemed during that big three era for the most part. And their bench, I feel like, and I was looking at numbers, and now I don't know if I'm misremembering, but I feel like their bench was really good for part of the year, but it really started to falter toward the end, and that's why I just thought there needed to be more staggering at some point. But I guess here's the interesting question now then, is we can assume that Blake Griffin and DeAndre Jordan are going to get a lot of their rest periods together. Mm-hmm. What is your favorite lineup, or what's the lineup you want to lean on most when neither of those two guys are on the floor?
For me, it's I like both Willie Reed and Montrezl Harrell. Pick your poison there at the five. I don't know. I wouldn't be surprised if Willie Reed doesn't make it, you know, into a Clippers uniform at all, given the circumstances that are going on with him.
I would not be surprised either.
Yeah, so we'll leave that one alone. But
Harrell as a small ball five too. I find that very interesting.
Yeah, I do too. So I would put Harrell at the five, Gallinari at the four, and then just based on the way that I look at their roster right now, like, geez, we're out of guys. Decker at the three, Lou Will at the two, and Teodosic at the one.
Do you think, and this could be a Wes Johnson type situation, because when they signed him to his new contract, or even when he was first there, it was always, oh, he's the guy, just that perimeter defender. Doesn't matter if he's going to give us any scoring, and he's hasn't really been that good. And I say that good, he's been pretty bad, or at least he couldn't see the floor, it seemed like last year. Is there a chance that DeAndre Liggins becomes more important to this roster than we realize right now?
Yeah, I really like Liggins, and I like Thornwell too, their rookie out of South Carolina. I think for his size, he's like 6'6". He can handle the ball like a point guard, makes really good decisions with it, defends, slashes. I mean, he's a very good player for them to bring off of that bench. So those two guys, I wouldn't be surprised if they carve out roles. But it's also a little bit as much about necessity as it is about their overpassing a guy like Wes Johnson or even Montrezl Harrell in terms of skill or need to play this guy. So, you know, we'll see how it goes. I mean, last year, one of the things that I liked about the Clippers' second unit was that they had Spates at the five, and then they could switch 1 through 4 with Felton, Rivers, Crawford, and Wes Johnson. When their second unit was at its peak, that's what they were doing defensively. So if they don't stagger Gallo and Griffin's minutes, and they put Willie Reed or Montrezl Harrell at the five, and then they play Decker and Wes Johnson, or one of those two guys at the four, and then a guy like Liggins or Thornwell, and they try to go with that same strategy, switch everything and have a less mobile post behind to clog up the paint, I wouldn't be shocked. And I think it might work.
And you know what's funny is we talk about, it seems like they just have so many options here, and I'm not necessarily sure what, there's a clear direction, but I'm just not necessarily sure what this team's identity should be outside of the offensive end or necessarily outside Griffin. And then you kind of look at the front office, and there seems like there are all these different cooks in the kitchen now, because you have Doc Rivers and you have Horace Frank, and you have to assume Jerry West carries some cachet around that organization. Steve Ballmer, I'm sure, is involved. I find that to be a very interesting dynamic as well. And while Woj over at ESPN had said that he didn't believe, or that people, sources don't believe, that Rivers' demotion, in essence, portends him leaving anytime soon, do you view it as anything more profound than just, oh, we need to make Doc's life easier?
Yeah, I definitely do. I just don't agree with all of the decisions that the Doc, the GM, has made. And sorry, I was just thinking for a minute. You said Woj at ESPN, and my mind still went crazy because I can't believe he's there.
It's still so weird seeing him on the television and stuff. There are his byline at ESPN.com. It's so bizarre.
It rubs me. I don't know. I get chills whenever I see. I still have Woj notifications on, and it pops up, and then I click on it. It's got the NBA on ESPN logo, and my mind just goes nuts. But anyway, back to Doc. He didn't succeed enough, and I think that there's more to it than just trying to make his life easier. That said, it is a very real byproduct of it, right? And when you have the chance to add a former executive of the year and a great basketball mind like Jerry West into the fold, you have to do it. Doc Rivers' appeal as a general manager at the beginning of his tenure there was his ability and his rapport to recruit veteran players. I think that what they wanted around a younger Blake, still in his prime Chris Paul, and a younger DeAndre Jordan, was somebody who's going to be able to get guys like J.J. Redick and get other players to come in and say, we want to help elevate this and be the pieces that maybe take a pay cut to come here and help build this team into a championship contender. But that never worked out for the Clippers. And when you have the chance to add Jerry West, especially coming into, and I'm sure we'll talk about this, a huge 2018 summer and for next year when everybody in Los Angeles is going to be recruiting from the rest of the league, you can't turn down the opportunity to make Jerry West kind of the guy that's overseeing everything. So whether it's West is calling the shots or Lawrence Frank is calling the shots, it doesn't matter. The image that they want and need to portray is that Jerry West is the guy that's going to be leading the charge here and is kind of the brain power behind the organization. Lawrence Frank is going to run the day-to-day, but has such a close relationship with Doc Rivers and what goes on the court that there's complete harmony in the organization, and that's what they're going to try to sell to their free agents next summer.
Their cap space situation next summer is going to be incredibly interesting because there's DeAndre Jordan has a player option, and the assumption with him and a lot of these other guys when they signed their deals in 2015 or 2016 was that they would opt out the first chance they get, but a lot of people, including myself, just misread the market last summer, and Tim McMahon and Bobby Marks, also now of ESPN.com, published a fantastic piece a week or two ago about how a lot of people around the league believe these free agents are going to get squeezed and they're not going to make as much money in 2018 because the market will still be correcting itself from 2016. And it kind of begs the question is, one, do you see DeAndre Jordan opting out still? I kind of still do. And then two, do you re-sign him? He's basically the NBA's Iron Man, and he's what someone like Drummond or Hassan Whiteside should aspire to be on defense, because it seems like he's kind of a sneaky good switcher for someone his size. But just with the way the direction of the league is headed, with how much money you have tied up in Blake Griffin and Danilo Gallinari, I find his free agency, and then maybe they want to go out and try and recruit guys and create extra cap space to get these kind of switchable wings who can guard across 3-4 positions, which is something that Jordan really can't do. I'm so intrigued to see what's going to happen with him. I don't think it'll get to a point where some initially thought he would enter the trade market when Chris Paul first left, but seeing how the Clippers kind of rebounded and responded with a roster that's built to win now, I don't think that happens. But his future with the team, I would still guess, even with kind of a less than enthusiastic market for centers around the association, is still up in the air.
So just pulled up my spreadsheets to try to take a look at their, you know, cap situation and whatnot moving forward. And next year there are only three players guaranteed to be under contract for the Clippers at the end of this coming season: Blake Griffin, Danilo Gallinari, and an unbelievable $5.0 million from Pat Beverly. Everyone else has a player option, a team option, or will be a free agent. Everybody else. So there's a lot of flexibility and maneuverability. I think before we can even dive into the DeAndre Jordan conversation, we have to think about, okay, who is it that they would try to go after if they didn't have Jordan? Because if they see somebody, they smell blood in the water that they really want on that free agent market next summer, that they think they have a realistic chance for, I would not be surprised if they trade Jordan by the trade deadline this year.
That's interesting to me, but it's just, I mean, their guaranteed commitments are weird, but to me, I would be genuinely surprised unless there's something going on again where Doc Rivers is going to overpay his son. I would be a little bit shocked to see Austin opt out of his contract. Milos Teodosic, I would be a little bit surprised if he opted out as well. There's no way Wes Johnson opts out, because I don't even know if he would be on an NBA roster if he opts out by that point. So I don't think they're going to be as flexible as their guaranteed deals suggest. And I also, what center you can replace, maybe you could replace, I don't want to use the term lion's share of what DeAndre Jordan does, but you could, if Dwayne Dedman decides to re-enter the free agent market, I think he has a player option. You can probably get by with someone who's noticeably cheaper than DeAndre Jordan, but now when you're kind of looking at your defense at the forward spots, having that tried and true, high volume, healthy, established fulcrum is incredibly important, and that's why it's just so fascinating to me. But then you look at the other teams, and you dive into their depth charts, and you consider those that are going to have cap space, and you're kind of like, well, who the heck is going to need a center that wants to make well into the eight figures? And you can't necessarily come up with anyone just because there isn't right now.
And on the same token as well, I mean, guys opt out of contracts all the time just to take more money from their current team. And that may be something that DeAndre does as well. So just because he opts out doesn't mean that there's going to be a strong suitors market for him, but it could mean that he's just looking to re-up for a longer deal with the Clippers. And I certainly understand that. You know, I like your point about Dedmon. He's a pretty good replacement as far as, you know, younger role player guys go. He can fill that DeAndre Jordan spot, okay. But I talk a lot about bookends on the court, the one and the five positions, where you defend a lot of pick and rolls, you're involved in a lot of pick and rolls, and that's really where your bread and butter versatility comes in, is being able to have guys that can not just fill one role. And I really would worry about the Clippers having two, I want to call them glorified role players, in Dedmon and Patrick Beverley running the one and the five there, because you're so pigeonholed into how much flexibility you have with the rest of your roster. So while I say I can envision a scenario in which the Clippers would trade Jordan by the trade deadline, that's only if they feel they have a legitimate shot with one of these free agents they fall in love with. And I don't think that will happen. So I think Jordan, probably whether he opts in or opts out, he's going to be a Clipper for the next few seasons. It's still a really fascinating offseason to try to look at, though, because as we've been talking about this whole podcast, they need help elsewhere on their roster. And where do they really create that flexibility if they have guys like Austin Rivers, Teodosic, Wesley Johnson, DeAndre Jordan, all opting in or taking more money to stay? I mean, where do you get those upgrades from?
You don't. And you know what actually might be a good barometer for the DJ situation? Nerlens Noel, who's clearly an inferior player at this point, but from a standpoint of, we know there's not a robust market for Noel right now, but the Dallas Mavericks are presumably still willing to pay him a long-term deal. If it's kind of going to be a similar situation, I would think, with DeAndre, were he to opt out. It's kind of known, yes, you're valuable, but at the same time, there aren't going to be a ton of teams around the league ready to offer you all this money. So if Noel is able to get close to market value or deal over the long term that guarantees him a lot of money, and DJ can look at it as kind of, well, you know, I don't need to make $20+ million in 1 year and go for that short-term windfall, because I can still get a four-year, maybe it's a four-year $70 million deal, or even a $60 million deal, just to guarantee long-term money. That might be a good gauge with what Noel gets in terms of length or his decision. Maybe he even decides, I want to go super short term because players and agents think that the market is going to be aggressive again in 2019. So that might factor into it, and probably not directly, but I think just looking at what happens when you're a quality big man without an aggressive free agent market.
Yeah. And we're talking about guys kind of locking up and trying to get that security for another big pay contract, but it's not like any of these guys are at the end of their earning sprees in the NBA. I mean, do you know who the oldest player is on the Clippers roster right now?
No, that's a good question.
There are three 30-year-olds. They have nobody who's 31 years old right now. Wes Johnson, Lou Williams, and Teodosic are the three guys who are in their 30s.
That's such a bizarre combination to have as your, you know, eldest veterans, so to speak.
Well, and beyond that, I mean, Blake Griffin and Jordan have been here together for a decade. And Gallo,
DeAndre Jordan's a freak. How many games has he missed in his career? It's less than 20. I think it's 16 or something crazy.
And Gallo, he had a career with the Knicks, and then they traded into the Nuggets, and he seems like he was there for almost a decade. And I mean, these guys, Lou Williams came into the league when he was young. He's over a 10-year veteran. He's barely 30 years old. I mean, there's experience on this team, but they're not old. So it's not like a lot of these guys are going to go away and say, oh, they're starting to hit that decline, so, you know, we can either get them on cheaper veteran deals, or we'll just move on and get somebody younger. Like, they're not old, and they're not on that depreciation slope quite yet.
Yes, and to correct myself before you started speaking, DJ has missed 8 games since 2010-2011. I forgot that he barely played when he first came into the league. So I guess with all this being said, where do you see the Clippers relative to the West? How many wins do you think they're going to end up with? I saw Kevin Pelton did his fantastic RPM predictions at ESPN.com, had them hovering around 48-49. That feels high to me for some reason, but where do you have them in terms of wins, and where could you see them? I guess let's do an optimistic and pessimistic finish prediction. Where could you see them going as high in the Western Conference standings, and is there a scenario where you could see them falling lower than people expect?
Okay, so for me, the most optimistic approach would be that 48 win scenario. They're kind of the 4 or the 5 seed, once again, slotted in there. And that goes with a year of health where everybody stays healthy, where Teodosic plays the way that a lot of the great Euro fans expect and anticipate him to play when he comes over to the NBA, and they get lights out performances and a big step forward from Austin Rivers this year, because he's going to be thrust into a really important role, especially defensively, and they need him to step up. So if he does that, I think 48, 49 wins. You know, they're kind of in that 4-5 slot where they're behind teams like Oklahoma City, Golden State, Houston, right around there with Oklahoma City, San Antonio, kind of wrestling for those 3-4-5 spots. Pessimistic approach for me is they're in kind of this just complete mesh of teams that are around 500 and all struggling to separate themselves into that 7 through 11. I don't even know what to call it out West. There's a ton of teams that are going to be kind of good. They have their flaws to them. But I think the Clippers, probably their worst case scenario is a 40 win team. And the reason I say that is because I don't think one injury necessarily cripples them this year, right? If Blake Griffin goes down, sure, they're weaker in their depth elsewhere, but maybe we get more Gallinari at the 4 and a lot of small ball, and they just ramp up their attack.
That would be something to see them play without Griffin for. I don't want him to get injured, by the way,
but right.
To end up seeing them have to play without Griffin again, and we're back to that same Chris Paul conversation where it's like, oh my God, are they better without Blake Griffin? That would be, after a 5-year, $170+ million deal, that would be something else.
I know, and I love Blake. Right? I think he's one of the most underrated guys in the league right now. I wrote about him. My first piece for NBA Math was how much I love Blake Griffin and his passing ability. But
so good.
I don't think that their season collapses without him. So I would put them as worst case scenario, 40 wins. We'll say 40, and they are the 10th seed that are just on the outside looking in, falling behind the likes of, you know, a team like Denver, Minnesota, Utah, New Orleans, who a bunch of these guys are trying to figure out who they are, as some of them are coming up, some of them are coming down, and where do you really slot them in comparison to each other?
Yeah, the West is a bloodbath. There are probably 12 teams that can talk themselves into chasing for a playoff berth. The Mavs say they're rebuilding, so we can go with 11 teams. Maybe put the Kings, after getting George Hill and Zebo and Carter, might actually think they're good. I don't think they do. But there are at least 11 teams who are going to talk themselves into a playoff berth, and that may ultimately be kind of what screws the Clippers, especially because I think you look at just the teams that missed the playoffs last year, we kind of almost have to pencil in the Timberwolves and the Nuggets for a playoff berth this year, is what I think makes things so tough to project. And who among the 8 teams that made it last year, besides the Clippers, would fall off? I think the Blazers and the Grizzlies are 2 teams that we can immediately go to, but it's just looking at that cluster, it's so hard to project. So I think they're going to get around 43 wins, and I think that might be good enough to get them the 7 or the 8 seed. I don't know if it's going to be – on the one hand, it's like, is this going to be a season where the 8 seed needs to have 50 wins? But on the other hand, it's like, well, you have 11, 12 teams who could really compete with each other, that they might just take away wins from each other. So I think 43, and they're, I don't want to use the word best case scenario, but it seems most likely to me would be 43, 44, and you get in as the 7-8. So do you kind of have like your own sweet spot for them?
Yeah, I think that's right around where mine would be. I mean, there are 3 locks to me for the postseason. There's more than three locks, but the three biggest locks are the Warriors, Rockets, and Spurs, right? Like I have just the hardest time. They were the three best teams in the West last year. I'm a really hard time imagining that they're not going to return to that level. Okay, there's five more playoff spots left. Would you take the Clippers over any team in the Northwest Division? The Nuggets, Timberwolves, Thunder, Blazers, or Jazz?
I would take them over the Blazers, I think, if we're assuming health. I don't want to discredit, you know, CJ McCollum and Damian Lillard, but Portland's offseason, you know, you shed Alan Krebs' contract, but he was one of the best spot-up shooters in the league, and you now have this front court logjam where I don't necessarily know. I guess you'll always have enough scoring and shooting with CJ and Dame.
They were great with Nurkic.
Yeah, that was 20-game sample size or whatever, but yeah, he was really good there, but maybe the Blazers, but I don't think you can look at, to your point, and say the Clippers are better than X out of that division.
Right, so there's coming up teams, like you mentioned, Denver, Minnesota, like we want to pencil them in a little bit. New Orleans, like who knows what's going on there because they have such a even more, you know, crazy.
They might be the strangest team. We were talking about the Clippers, but yeah. You look at the Pelicans, I think I could talk myself into like, but you know, they have DeMarcus and Anthony Davis. If Rondo keeps shooting the way he's been shooting, that they could get 50 plus. But then it's like, yeah, they might get 37.
Right. They have a wider window than a team like the Clippers, which might make them stranger. But it's also a lot more apparent, kind of what they're going to try. Just move the ball with their two point guards around two big men that are really skilled and will be able to play with each other. But I mean, if we want to pencil those three teams, Denver, Minnesota, and New Orleans in, okay, now we've got six, and then Oklahoma City, a very talented team, makes seven. I mean, there's one playoff spot left for Portland, Utah, Memphis. It's really hard for me to be anything more than tepid on the Clippers because, like you said, it's a bloodbath out there. And, you know, they have some questions and some issues on the defensive end that, you know, I look at a lot of these teams and there's questions for every single one of them, but I have a lot easier time believing that the fix is on their current roster than I do on this Clippers team.
So to I guess round it up, playoffs or not for the Clippers next year?
I'm going to say eight seed.
I like it. I'm with you. Yep. So that was our 2017-2018 Clippers preview. They are going to be an extremely fun, if strange, if frustrating, if beautiful, if terrible team to watch next season. If you want to talk to Adam Moore about this on Twitter and get at him for his hot takes, his handle is @Spinella14. That's SPINELLA14. Again, he writes over at NBA Math. He does stuff for B-Ball Breakdown. And he is an assistant men's basketball coach over at Washington and Jefferson. So it was a blast having you on, Adam. I hope you enjoyed it. I think everyone learned a lot about the Clippers. And if listeners want to get at me, they can find me on Twitter @DanFavale, FAVALE. They can follow NBA Math @NBA_math. And they can also get at Hardwood Knox on Twitter as well, or even Andy Bailey, who abandoned you today as well. He is @AndrewDBailey. I will not be doing the usual shout out to Bino Udre because I still think that that's a ridiculous implementation that Andy subscribes to. So until next time.